The invoice sat on the desk longer than it should have. It was old paper tied to an old deal, but the numbers were wrong. Advisory fees in the hundreds of millions for companies that barely existed. A new chief executive in Tokyo read it twice, then again. No one else in the room reacted. The silence felt practiced. It was early 2011. Olympus had survived wars, recessions, and scandals that never made headlines. Inside the company, loyalty mattered more than questions. The explanation offered was simple. This is how it had always been done. The CEO did not accept that answer. He asked for documents. He asked for dates. He asked who approved the payments. Each request slowed meetings. Each email went unanswered longer than the last. Somewhere inside those fees was a truth buried for decades. Finding it would mean breaking ranks. Not finding it would mean becoming part of the cover that had already lasted too long. Chapter 1. The invoice that did not make sense. The paper was ordinary. Cream stock. Black ink. It came from a stack meant for routine review, the kind that passed across executive desks without friction. This one did not move. The numbers held it in place. It was early 2011, and the new chief executive of Olympus Corporation sat alone in a Tokyo office built for consensus. He had arrived from outside the company, outside the culture, and outside the expectations that governed how questions were asked. He had been hired to modernize governance and steady a business that made cameras, scopes, and medical devices trusted around the world. The invoice in front of him listed advisory fees tied to acquisitions completed years earlier. The amounts were staggering. Hundreds of millions of dollars paid to financial advisors for deals that had closed quietly and without public drama. The target companies were small. Some had little operating history. One appeared to exist mostly on paper. Nothing about the math aligned with the stated purpose. The chief executive reread the line items. He checked the dates. He checked the approvals. Then he checked the supporting documents and found gaps where explanations should have been. He did not raise his voice. He did not accuse anyone. He asked for context. The response came quickly and carefully. Senior finance staff explained that the fees reflected standard practice at the time. The deals were complex. The market had been volatile. Japan had endured a long recovery from the collapse of its asset bubble. Decisions made in the 1990s could not be judged by modern standards. This explanation was not presented as a defense. It was presented as closure. The chief executive did not close the file. He requested additional records related to the acquisitions. He asked for internal memos, board minutes, and third-party correspondence. The requests were polite and precise. They were also unusual. Inside Olympus, authority flowed downward. Questions that moved upward disrupted balance. The documents arrived in fragments. Some files showed shell entities registered offshore. Others showed payments routed through intermediaries with no clear operational role. The language used in the paperwork was vague. Words like restructuring, settlement, and advisory appeared without detail. The transactions were legal on their face. What troubled the chief executive was not a single payment, but the pattern. He asked the finance division to walk him through the purpose of each acquisition. The meetings were calm, slides were presented, history was summarized. No one admitted uncertainty. No one volunteered risk. When he asked why Olympus had paid more in advisory fees than the purchase price of the companies themselves, the room went quiet. A senior executive responded that these matters had been approved by previous leadership and reviewed by auditors. Revisiting them would create unnecessary confusion. That was the moment the chief executive understood the nature of the resistance. This was not incompetence, it was containment. According to later reporting and regulatory findings, Olympus had faced massive investment losses during the 1990s following the collapse of Japan's asset bubble. At the time, many Japanese firms sought ways to defer or conceal those losses rather than recognize them publicly. One method involved transferring losses off the balance sheet through complex transactions. This practice became known as tobashi. What was proven years later was not yet visible in full. What was visible to the chief executive in early 2011 was that certain acquisitions appeared to function less as growth strategies and more as financial instruments. The inflated prices and extraordinary fees suggested money moving with purpose, but not with transparency. He ordered an internal review. The directive was modest. It did not accuse. It did not threaten. It asked a simple question. Why were these fees paid, and what losses were they intended to address, if any? The reaction was immediate. Executives warned him that reopening old matters could damage relationships with banks and advisors. They reminded him that Olympus had survived precisely because it valued harmony and discretion. One board member suggested that Western governance norms did not always translate well in Japan. The message was clear. The inquiry itself was the problem. Emails began to slow. Meetings were postponed. Answers were routed through committees. The chief executive found himself isolated in a company he technically led. He documented everything. He kept copies. He made notes after conversations that ended without resolution. At this stage, there was no public allegation of fraud. There was no regulatory inquiry. There was only a growing divide between a chief executive asking how the past had been handled and an organization that believed the past had already been settled. Independent auditors were consulted. Their role was limited. The information provided to them was curated. Without full access, they could not see the entire structure. This limitation would later become central to understanding how the scheme endured. Inside Olympus, the tone hardened. The board questioned the chief executive's judgment. They questioned his loyalty. They questioned whether his insistence on transparency served the company's interests. He was reminded that he was a guest in a culture that valued restraint. He did not back down. He escalated his concerns to the board in writing. He stated that the advisory fees lacked sufficient explanation. He stated that the acquisitions did not appear to create shareholder value. He stated that without clarity, the company faced material risk. These statements were factual. They were not yet accusations, but they crossed a line. The board's response was procedural. Committees were formed. Outside counsel was mentioned. No timeline was given. In the meantime, the chief executive's authority was quietly undermined. Decisions required additional approvals. Communication channels narrowed. What he did not yet know was how far back the pattern extended. What later investigations would prove was that Olympus had used a series of acquisitions and inflated fees to absorb losses generated years earlier. These losses stemmed from investments made during the height of Japan's bubble economy. When markets collapsed, recognizing those losses would have damaged the company's standing. Instead, they were moved, masked, and delayed. That truth had not yet surfaced. What existed in early 2011 was a file that refused to make sense, and a corporate culture that treated that refusal as a threat. The chief executive faced a choice. He could accept the explanations offered and allow the matter to close, or he could continue pressing, knowing that doing so would isolate him further and potentially end his tenure. He chose to continue. He requested a truly independent investigation, separate from internal controls. He understood the risk. He also understood that once the question had been asked, not answering it carried its own cost. The pressure did not come with shouting or threats. It came with silence. It came with meetings where his agenda items were deferred. It came with subtle reminders that leadership in Japan was not exercised alone. By the end of the quarter, the chief executive knew something else as well. If the transactions were exposed, they would not implicate a single decision or a single executive. They would reveal a system designed to protect the company at the expense of truth. And systems do not forgive those who challenge them. The invoice remained on his desk, copied and filed. It was no longer just a question about fees. It was the first visible seam in a structure built to hide losses for decades. Chapter 2, the silence inside the company. The documents did not arrive all at once. They surfaced in pieces, separated by years and departments, each one ordinary on its own. Together, they formed a trail that pointed backward, long before the chief executive's arrival, long before the acquisitions that first raised concern. The story began in the early 1990s, after Japan's asset bubble collapsed. Stock prices fell, real estate values cratered. Companies that had borrowed aggressively during the boom were left holding investments worth a fraction of what they had paid. Losses mounted quietly across corporate Japan. For many firms, admitting those losses outright would have meant reputational damage, tighter credit, and public scrutiny. Inside that environment, certain financial practices emerged that allowed companies to delay recognition. One of those practices was later described by regulators and journalists as Tobashi. The method was technical but simple in intent. Losses were transferred off the balance sheet, often through complex transactions involving affiliated entities, investment funds, or intermediaries. The goal was not profit. The goal was time. Time for markets to recover. Time for balance sheets to look clean. What the chief executive saw in the Olympus records matched that logic. Several acquisitions made in the 2000s appeared to have little strategic rationale. The companies acquired did not expand product lines or open new markets. Instead, they came with unusually high purchase prices and extraordinary advisory fees. Those fees were paid to entities that had facilitated the transactions but offered limited ongoing value. According to later confirmed findings, those inflated prices and fees were used to absorb losses generated years earlier. The acquisitions functioned as containers. Money moved in, losses disappeared, and the books balanced. Inside Olympus, this history was treated as settled. When the chief executive asked senior executives about the origins of the losses, he was told they were irrelevant. The focus, he was reminded, should be on current performance. Revisiting past financial decisions would create unnecessary instability. The explanations shared a common trait. They avoided specifics. Board minutes from the period showed approvals without detailed discussion. External advisors were referenced but not named in depth. Risk assessments were minimal. The language emphasized trust, continuity, and discretion. The chief executive pressed further. He requested a clear accounting of how the acquisition prices had been calculated. He asked why advisory fees exceeded industry norms by orders of magnitude. He asked who benefited from the transactions beyond the stated sellers. The answers did not come. Instead, the tone shifted. Executives who had once been cooperative became guarded. Meetings shortened. Conversations moved off the record. He was advised more than once that his approach was creating discomfort. That discomfort was not about exposure to regulators. It was about exposure to memory. For decades, Olympus had operated within a system where seniority and consensus mattered more than documentation. Decisions were justified by trust in leadership. Challenging those decisions implied distrust, not just of individuals, but of the institution itself. The chief executive's questions broke that understanding. According to reporting that followed, internal emails revealed a coordinated effort to downplay the issue. Executives discussed how to respond without conceding fault. They debated whether the chief executive understood Japanese corporate norms. Some suggested that his continued inquiries posed a risk to the company's stability. In what was not debated was whether the transactions had occurred. By this stage, the chief executive no longer viewed the issue as isolated accounting. He viewed it as systemic concealment. He documented his concerns and shared them with the board, emphasizing that failure to address the matter could expose Olympus to severe consequences if discovered externally. The board responded with process. Committees were convened. Legal advice was sought. The language used was careful and noncommittal. The chief executive was thanked for his diligence and told the matter would be reviewed. Behind closed doors, the calculation was different. Allowing the investigation to continue risked unraveling decisions made by former executives who still held influence. It risked implicating advisors, banks, and auditors who had long-standing relationships with the company. It risked confirming that the culture of silence had been intentional. Stopping the investigation meant stopping the investigator. Pressure increased. The chief executive's authority was questioned in subtle ways. His strategic initiatives were delayed. His communication with staff was monitored. He was excluded from informal discussions where consensus was built. None of this was explicit punishment. It was structural resistance. At the same time, external scrutiny loomed closer. Financial journalists had begun asking questions about Olympus's acquisitions. Analysts noted inconsistencies in reported figures. Rumors circulated, though no formal inquiry had yet begun. The chief executive recognized the narrowing window. He considered his options. Continuing internally risked dismissal before the truth emerged. Going public risked legal retaliation and professional isolation. Remaining silent would make him complicit. He chose escalation. He shared his concerns outside the company, first with trusted advisors, then with regulators and the press, according to later accounts. He provided documentation. He explained the patterns he had identified. He made clear which facts were proven and which required investigation. This decision marked the point of no return. Inside Olympus, the response was swift. The board moved to assert control. They framed the issue as a leadership problem rather than a financial one. They questioned the chief executive's judgment and suitability. They cited cultural misunderstandings and communication failures. The narrative shifted from accounting to conduct. What the board did not address publicly was the substance of his claims. As pressure mounted, the company prepared to remove him. The process was procedural, rooted in governance language, but driven by urgency. The priority was containment. Delay increased the risk that regulators would act first. The chief executive understood this dynamic. He continued to document every interaction. He preserved emails and meeting notes. He ensured that his concerns were recorded outside the company's control. By the time the board moved against him, the truth had already begun to surface beyond Olympus's walls. The silence that had protected the company for decades was breaking, not because of a single invoice, but because the system built to hide losses could not withstand scrutiny once someone refused to stop asking why. The countdown had begun. Chapter 3, Exposure and Aftermath. The dismissal came quickly and without ceremony. In mid-2011, Olympus announced that its chief executive had been removed. The public explanation cited differences in management style and communication. The company emphasized continuity. It insisted operations would remain stable. The timing told a different story. Within days, financial journalists began publishing details that matched the concerns the former chief executive had raised internally. Advisory fees, inflated acquisition prices, offshore entities. The questions Olympus had tried to keep contained were now public. At first, the company denied wrongdoing. Executives stated that all transactions had been properly approved and audited. They described the acquisitions as strategic decisions made in good faith. They framed the controversy as a misunderstanding fueled by cultural differences and incomplete information. That position did not hold. As reporting intensified, Japanese regulators opened formal inquiries. Independent investigators were appointed. For the first time, Olympus was required to produce full documentation without internal filtering. What emerged was not speculation. Regulatory findings later confirmed that Olympus had concealed massive investment losses dating back to the 1990s. Those losses originated from failed investments made during Japan's bubble economy. Rather than recognize them publicly, the company used a series of complex transactions to move the losses off its balance sheet. The mechanism was now clear. Olympus had overpaid for several companies with limited strategic value. It had paid extraordinary advisory fees to intermediaries. Those inflated payments absorbed the losses and allowed the company to present cleaner financial statements year after year. This was not an accounting error. It was a deliberate strategy. Investigators concluded that the scheme had been known to senior executives and maintained across multiple leadership transitions. Auditors had failed to detect or challenge the structure, in part because information was withheld or obscured. As the findings became public, Olympus's share price collapsed. Investor confidence evaporated. The company's reputation, built over decades, was severely damaged in a matter of weeks. Arrests followed. Several former executives were charged based on documented evidence. Prosecutors focused on falsified financial statements and violations of securities law. The charges were specific. They were grounded in records, not assumptions. Courts later convicted key figures involved in the concealment. Sentences reflected the seriousness of the offenses, but also the complexity of the case. The scheme had not enriched individuals directly in obvious ways. Its purpose had been preservation, not profit. That distinction did not lessen its impact. Olympus faced fines and regulatory sanctions. It was forced to restate years of financial results. The company underwent sweeping governance reforms, including changes to board composition and oversight structures. International observers pointed to the scandal as a case study in the risks of unchecked corporate culture. In Japan, where consensus and loyalty often outweighed confrontation, Olympus became a symbol of what happened when silence replaced accountability. The former chief executive watched these developments from outside the company. He had lost his position. His reputation had been attacked publicly before being restored. For a period, he was portrayed as disruptive rather than principled. That narrative shifted as facts emerged. Regulators acknowledged that his actions had accelerated the exposure of the scheme. Journalists credited his refusal to accept vague explanations. Investors recognized that without his intervention, the losses might have remained hidden even longer. The personal cost was significant. Breaking ranks inside a rigid corporate system carried consequences beyond employment. Professional relationships were strained, opportunities narrowed. The decision to speak had been correct, but it was not without damage. Inside Olympus, the reckoning was uneven. The executives directly involved faced legal consequences. Others who had benefited from the culture of silence moved on quietly. The systems that allowed the scheme to persist were adjusted, but not entirely dismantled. Corporate Japan absorbed the lesson selectively. Some companies strengthened governance and transparency. Others treated Olympus as an anomaly rather than a warning. The pressure to maintain appearances did not disappear. It adapted. What remained undeniable was the record. For more than a decade, Olympus had hidden losses through deliberate transactions. The scheme had survived audits, leadership changes, and market cycles. It had ended not because the system corrected itself, but because one individual refused to stop asking why. The scandal reshaped conversations about corporate accountability, both in Japan and globally. It exposed the limitations of oversight when trust replaces verification. It showed how easily complex financial structures could be used to obscure reality when no one challenged them. In the aftermath, Olympus survived as a company. It restructured, it refocused, its products remained respected. But the story of how it protected itself at the expense of truth became inseparable from its history. The final cost was not measured only in fines or prison sentences. It was measured in lost trust. For years, investors believed Olympus's financial statements reflected reality. Employees believed leadership acted in the company's best interests. Regulators believed audits had meaning. All of those beliefs were shaken. The cover-up ended, but the conditions that allowed it had not vanished entirely. Corporate systems still reward silence. Hierarchies still resist disruption. Whistleblowers still pay a price. The difference after Olympus was awareness. The invoice that once sat quietly on a desk became evidence. The questions that were once dismissed became public record. And the truth, delayed for decades, finally carried weight. Not because the system wanted it to, because someone chose not to look away.